and let me turn the music down. Welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll feature stories from the Washington Post, from the BBC, from the New York Times, and more. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the August 21st edition of the Washington Post. The headline, Court Upholds Convictions Against Highest-Ranking Catholic Official Jailed on Charges of Child Sex Abuse. This article is by A. Odysseus Patrick of the Washington Post, Dateline, Sydney. The most senior priest jailed for child abuse in the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church failed to convince an Australian court on Wednesday that he was the victim of a miscarriage of justice. Australian Cardinal George Pell will have to continue to serve his 6-year jail term for sexually assaulting two choir boys who had sneaked into his changing rooms to drink sacramental wine in Melbourne's Grand St. Patrick's Cathedral 23 years ago. In a case that caused bitter division among Catholics, the Chief Justice of the Victorian Supreme Court, Anne Ferguson, said she was convinced by the evidence of the only living witness, a Melbourne man who had accused the conservative prelate of surprising his younger self and brutally assaulting him in front of a school friend who was attacked too. This complainant was a very compelling witness, Ferguson said in a summary of her judgment that was broadcast live over the Internet. He was clearly not a liar, was not a fantasist, and was a witness of truth. Another appeal to the High Court is possible, although the highest court rarely overturns criminal convictions. In a statement, the Vatican acknowledged the decision, noting that Pell had always maintained his innocence and could still appeal to the High Court. It also reiterated its commitment to pursue members of the clergy involved in abuse through the competent ecclesiastical authorities. Pell, who oversaw the Vatican's finances before he was charged, was found guilty in December of one count of sexual penetration of a child under 16 and 4 counts of an indecent act against a child under 16. He was sentenced on March 13th. In their submission, Pell's lawyers argued that the original trial was unfair because the cardinal wasn't able to present evidence they say demonstrated it would have been impractical for him to molest the boys given the amount of time available after conducting a Sunday Mass. They also said Pell, who was the city's archbishop at the time, could not have exposed his genitals because of the heavy clothing he was wearing. Ferguson and another judge, Chris Maxwell, examined Pell's robes and weren't convinced by the argument, nor did they accept that there were any procedural or legal flaws in the trial. Pell's robes had also been made available to the jury, which reached a unanimous verdict. The appeal decision wasn't unanimous. A third judge, Mark Weinberg, said he believed that the victim's evidence could have been concocted and was implausible and unconvincing. Although the three judges didn't hear from the man in person, they watched a video recording of his allegations against Pell and the cardinal's denials in an interview with police detectives. Ferguson told Pell that he would have to return to jail and that he would be eligible for parole after spending 3 years and 8 months in prison. "Please take Cardinal Pell from the courtroom," she said. Last August, the church publicly apologized for the thousands of victims of abuse in Australia and pledged that it would never happen again. Church critics were jubilant at Wednesday's decision, which legal experts had said could go either way. "Pell is a pedophile," tweeted Chris Murphy, a prominent Australian criminal defense lawyer. "Woe betide those who clapped him as a saint." Before he went to jail, Pell circulated among the international elite. Even after he was found guilty, he received character references from several prominent Australians, including former Prime Minister John Howard. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Pell will be stripped of his Order of Australia honor. Next up on Religion in the News, an article from August 18th that was published on the BBC's website. The article is titled, "The New Yorker Reviving Jewish Life on a Holiday Island." And the article is by Miriam Annenberg of the BBC. An American who landed in Majorca 5 years ago soon found himself working to revive the Mediterranean island's Jewish community, with the help of families forced to convert from Judaism to Christianity 500 years ago. When Danny Rothstein arrived in Palma in 2014, he was planning only a short break from the crowds and chaos of New York City. But when he fell in love with the Catalan woman, he decided to stay. The pair got married in May of 2017. Danny was very happy, but something was missing. If Majorca was to become his permanent home, he needed to find a Jewish community. And Majorca's Jews had been burned, exiled, or forcibly converted during the Spanish Inquisition. "I literally came to Majorca thinking I would never find anyone Jewish or anything Jewish," Danny says. By the time he got married, he already knew there was Jewish life on Majorca. There was a synagogue, anyway, though it came to life only for Friday evening prayers, and even then struggled to attract the necessary 10 men. Jewish families on the island rarely came together for Shabbat dinners or other Jewish holidays. It was hard for Danny to imagine raising his family under conditions so different from those of his own New Jersey childhood. So he began searching for solutions. Around the same time, Tony Pena found himself on a journey of a different kind. Unlike Danny, a lifelong Jew new to Majorca, Tony was a lifelong Majorcan new to Judaism. Tony is a Chueta, one of roughly 20,000 descendants of the Jews forcibly converted during the Inquisition. Like most Chuetas, Tony grew up Christian, but although his family had been Catholic for generations, Majorcans still treated him differently. His Chueta surname set him apart. His classmates bullied him and made fun of his heritage. If a girl were to date a Chueta, her parents would say, "He's the one who killed Jesus Christ," he says. At the age of 12, Tony gave up on religion altogether. But in middle age, he grew interested in exploring his Jewish roots. As Danny settled into life in Majorca, he began learning about its hidden Jewish history. He'd never heard of the Chuetas, even though his mother taught Jewish education. "I take it personally," he says. "I'm like, how has this incredible story not made it out of the island, or to Spain for that matter?" The first attack on Palma's Jewish quarter in 1391 killed between 100 and 300 Jews. Later, as the Inquisition gathered momentum, the majority of Jewish Majorcans converted under duress, though many continued practicing Judaism in secret. Hundreds of those converts were tortured and killed throughout the 1400s and 1500s. When 37 Jews tried to escape by boat in 1688, they were captured. After 3 years of torture, inquisitors killed them in 1691, burning 3 alive at the stake. They hung a list of their surnames in the Santo Domingo convent for all to see, which stayed up until 1820. Their descendants became known as the Chuetas, from the Catalan word meaning bacon. In addition to learning about the Chuetas, Danny discovered that the existing Jewish community in Majorca was fractured. Over the years, control of the synagogue had changed hands. British expats had given way to Orthodox Jews, and then to Sephardic Jews, each with their own style of prayer. Among the worshippers were Sephardim and Ashkenazi, Orthodox and Reform, with their various different traditions. There was no consensus about which prayers to include, the participation of women, or the role of the synagogue in organizing social events, and no rabbi to resolve tensions. People attended weekly services, but that was it. Danny also learned that not long previously, Palma had held a half-day Limud, a Jewish learning conference open to all, encompassing religion, culture, and tradition. He thought more of this could be what Majorca needed. He contacted organizer Karen Kochman with a proposition. How did she feel about putting on a full weekend-long event with him in 2018 in order to bring everyone together, Chuetas included? "I said, we're going to do Limud," Danny says. "We just did it, somehow, some way." So Majorca's diverse Jewish community came together for a weekend, and a number of Chuetas told their stories, including Tony, who talked about his own unusual journey to Judaism. As a professional chef, Tony enjoys learning the history behind the things he cooks. He can trace the origins of popular Majorcan dishes back to the eras of Roman and Muslim rule on the island. Since there is evidence of Jews on Majorca as early as the 4th century, he knew Jewish food must have existed too. But when he went looking for these recipes, he failed. There was nothing there, he says. Everything was erased. His quest to understand Jewish cuisine led him to the Torah, and he was surprised to find that some of his grandmother's cooking habits, the distinctive way she killed animals, her avoidance of pork or pork fat, and the words she uttered over certain foods before eating, all were echoed in the traditional rules of cooking found in the Torah and other religious texts. He believes his family had kept these traditions alive for generations without remembering where they came from. This wasn't the case in all Chueta families. Some not only cooked pork, but cooked it outside so that everyone could see. It was one of many ways they worked hard to prove their devotion to Christianity, even centuries after their families had converted. Some also opened their windows wide as they performed housework on Saturdays, the Jewish Sabbath. In Catalan, the phrase, to work on Saturday, is an idiomatic way of referring to housework, which some suspect has its origins in this practice. Tony's own family showed its commitment by rarely missing a church service. As I grew up, I got so tired of it, he says, tired of having to prove myself. As Spain evolved after the death in 1975 of the dictator, General Francisco Franco, foreign tourists began flocking to Mallorca. In time, Jewish and British Jews put down roots, raised money, and opened a synagogue, watched carefully by some chuetas. It sparked their curiosity, Tony says. He was one of them. Eventually, he joined about a dozen other chuetas in returning to Judaism and officially converted in Israel in 2013. He went back there 5 years later to marry another Chueta convert, Francisca Maria Olivar Valls, under a traditional wedding canopy, a chupa, in the West Bank town of Migdal Oz. Danny felt strongly that the Chuetas should be embraced as part of the island's wider Jewish family, even if they were not practicing Jews. Others weren't so sure. Converted Chuetas like Tony were already becoming stalwarts of the Palma Synagogue and some of the most devout Jews on the island. But how far the synagogue should welcome those who have not converted is an issue that continues to divide opinion. A respected Israeli Orthodox rabbi ruled in 2011 that all Chuetas were Jewish by virtue of their family history. One side effect of the years of discrimination is that marriages with non-Chuetas remained rare. But some of the more observant of Mallorca's Jews feel uncomfortable counting Chuetas who have not officially converted in their minyan, the minimum number of 10 Jewish men required to pray. It's a big culture shock, I guess, says Karen, because in the UK or in Germany or even in Israel, you don't have people who pop out of nowhere who are like, oh yeah, my great-great-grandfather is now Jewish and now, out of the blue, I'm interested. But the return of Chuetas to Judaism has also created some frictions within the Chueta community itself. Like others in his community, Tony was raised to keep his background to himself. By openly becoming a Jew, he drew direct attention to his heritage, and some thought increased the risk of the Chueta having to bear the brunt of anti-Semitism as well as anti-Chueta prejudice. It's not such a far-fetched idea. In the 1970s, Chuetas who owned the jewelry shops along Carrera de l'Argenteria in Palma, also known as Jewelers Row, found swastikas spray-painted across their storefronts after a local television station broadcast a series on the Holocaust. Even today, kids use Chueta as an insult meaning stingy, a common anti-Semitic trope, and it's no secret that anti-Semitism has been on the rise across Europe. The revival of Jewish life on Mallorca, thanks partly to Danny and Tony, has taken place regardless. A Hanukkah celebration attracted 150 people, including 40 children, while 40 attended a recent Shabbat dinner. Everyone kind of looked around saying, "Where did all these Jews come from?" Danny says. In recent years, a tiny Jewish history museum has opened in the old Jewish quarter, a labyrinthine collection of winding roads and forked intersections east of the cathedral. Danny, meanwhile, has opened a Jewish tourism company. Among other things, he points out to visitors the groove running along the alley-side wall of Mount Zion Church that once housed a synagogue. Rumor has it that generations of Chuetas ran their hands along the stones as they passed it by in recognition of the building's Jewish roots, wearing down the stone. Tony recently made a historical discovery of his own. While looking through old documents, he learned that a man with his name, Antonio Pena, married a woman with his wife's name, Francisca, in Palma centuries ago. They were both killed in the Inquisition. It feels like reincarnation, he says. Here they are hundreds of years later. They found themselves again. Last year, when Mallorca's Jewish community held board elections, they elected an entirely new slate, including Danny and Tony, and a second Chueta, the journalist and writer Miguel Segura. So two of the four board members are now of Chueta descent. For Danny and Tony, this is an opportunity to forge a more inclusive community, but there is also a danger of deepening existing rifts. We don't have the answer of what Mallorca Judaism is going to look like in 5 to 10 years, Danny says. I think our challenge, if we wish to accept it, and I think we do, is trying to find the shared values that connect all these Jews. We'll turn next on Religion in the News to an article that appeared in the Sunday Review of the New York Times on August 2nd. The headline, The Nuns Who Bought and Sold Human Beings. Subheadline, America's nuns are beginning to confront their ties to slavery, but it's still a long road to repentance. This is by Rachel L. Swarns, who's listed as a contributing writer for the New York Times. Georgetown Visitation Preparatory School, one of the oldest Roman Catholic girls' schools in the nation, has long celebrated the vision and generosity of its founders, a determined band of Catholic nuns who championed free education for the poor in the early 1800s. The sisters, who established an elite academy in Washington, D.C., also ran a Saturday school free to any young girl who wished to learn, including slaves, at a time when public schools were almost non-existent and teaching slaves to read was illegal, according to an official history posted for several years on the school's website. But when a newly hired school archivist and historian started digging in the convent's records a few years ago, she found no evidence that the nuns had taught enslaved children to read or write. Instead, she found records that documented a darker side of the order's history. The Georgetown Visitation Sisters owned at least 107 enslaved men, women, and children, the records show, and they sold dozens of these people to pay debts and to help finance the expansion of their school and the construction of a new chapel. Nothing else to do than dispose of the family of Negroes, Mother Agnes Brent, the convent superior, wrote in 1821 as she approved the sale of a couple and their two young children. The enslaved woman was just days away from giving birth to her third child. Nuns disposing of black families? I've been poring over 19th century church records for several years now, and such casual cruelty from leaders of the faith still takes my breath away. I'm a black journalist and a black Catholic, yet I grew up knowing nothing about the nuns who bought and sold human beings. For generations, enslaved people have been largely left out of the origin story traditionally told about the Catholic Church. My reporting on Georgetown University, which profited from the sale of more than 200 slaves, has helped to draw attention in recent years to universities and their ties to slavery. But slavery also helped to fuel the growth of many contemporary institutions, including some churches and religious organizations. Historians say that nearly all of the orders of Catholic sisters established by the late 1820s owned slaves. Today, many Catholic sisters are outspoken champions of social justice, and some are grappling with this painful history, even as lawmakers in Congress and presidential candidates debate whether reparations should be paid to the descendants of enslaved people. Their approaches vary in scope, and some sisters have expressed misgivings, fearful that exposing the past may leave them open to criticism. But as they search their archives and reflect on the way forward, some religious women are developing frameworks that may serve as roadmaps for other institutions striving to acknowledge and atone for their participation in America's system of human bondage. The Georgetown Visitation Sisters and school officials have organized a series of discussions for students, faculty, staff, and alumni, including a prayer service in April that commemorated the enslaved people whose involuntary sacrifices supported the growth of this school. They've published an online report about the convent's slaveholding. An article by the school's archivist and historian also appeared in the U.S. Catholic Historian this spring, and have digitized their records related to slavery, making them available to the public for the first time. The religious of the Sacred Heart, who owned about 150 enslaved people in Louisiana and Missouri, tracked down dozens of descendants of the people they once owned and invited them to a memorial ceremony in Grand Coteau, Louisiana. At the ceremony last fall, the nuns unveiled a monument to the slaves in the local parish cemetery and a plaque on an old slave quarters. They also announced the creation of a scholarship fund for African-American students at their Catholic school, which was built in part by enslaved laborers. It wasn't just a question of looking at the past, Sister Carolyn Osiak, the provincial archivist for the Society of the Sacred Heart, United States, Canada, said. It was, what do we do with this now? Sister Osiak, who led the Society of the Sacred Heart's Committee on Slavery and Reconciliation, said her order wanted the descendants to know that their ancestors had played a vital role in developing and sustaining the convent and school. The religious of the Sacred Heart are members of the Society of the Sacred Heart. We couldn't have done it without you, she said, describing the message delivered to the descendants by the order's provincial leader. For so long we haven't acknowledged you, and we're sorry about that. But the soul-searching has not been universally embraced. Some descendants declined to participate in the ceremony in Louisiana, finding it too painful, and some nuns have expressed unease about their decision to unearth the past. A lot of communities now are very committed to dealing with issues of racism, but the fact is their own history is problematic, says Margaret Susan Thompson, a historian at Syracuse University who has examined Catholic nuns and race in the United States. They're beginning to confront their own racism and their own complicity in the racism of the past, she said, but it's a very long road. Sister Irma L. Dillard, an African-American member of the Religious of the Sacred Heart, said that while some white nuns feel reluctant to revisit this history because they fear being racist, seen as racist and bad, she praised the steps taken by her order so far and said she hopes more will be done. She said that only one scholarship has been given so far, a gesture that she described as a token. And while she would like to see the order's history of slaveholding incorporated into the curriculum of the schools they founded, few of those schools have publicly acknowledged their origins, she said, despite the extensive research that has been done. Not one of the school websites has anything about enslavement, said Sister Dillard, who is also a member of the Society's Committee on Slavery, Accountability, and Reconciliation. We've whitewashed our history. At Georgetown Visitation, Susan Nalizetti, the school archivist and historian, discovered that the order's ties to slavery were much deeper than had been previously publicized. None of the official histories described the extent of the sisters' slaveholding or detailed the nuns' profits from the sale of humans. And for more than a decade, the school's website hailed the Georgetown Visitation nuns for their generosity of spirit for teaching slaves to read, an anecdote that was passed down through oral tradition, school officials said. That language, which remains unsubstantiated, was removed from the website in 2017. The committee is happy, the school is happy to now have information so that we can speak on this history with authority based on what the documentary evidence tells us, Dr. Nalizetti said. It is history that has largely faded from our public consciousness. Even among many of the 3 million black Catholics, who account for about 3% of Catholics in the United States. Growing up in New York City, I lived just blocks from a convent that ran a bookstore and a community festival that became a highlight of my childhood summers. Catholic nuns educated my mother, my aunts, three of my uncles, and both my sisters. My mother and her family, who emigrated from the Bahamas to Staten Island, even lived for a time on a farm run by Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic worker movement and a candidate for sainthood. The church we knew tended to Irish and Italian immigrants, their children and grandchildren, and a smattering of black families. We never imagined that any of its religious orders had ties to slavery. In the early decades of the American Republic, the Catholic Church established its primary foothold in the South, in communities where slaveholding was considered a mark of wealth and prestige for parishioners, clergy, and nuns. It was not unusual for American-born priests and nuns to grow up in slaveholding families, and many orders relied on slave labor, historians say. The Jesuit priests, who founded and ran Georgetown, for instance, were among the largest slaveholders in Maryland. And as women began to enter the first Catholic convents in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, some brought their human property with them as part of their dowries, historians say. Wealthy supporters and relatives of the nuns also donated enslaved people to the convents. Meanwhile, Catholic sisters bought, sold, and bartered enslaved people. Some nuns accepted slaves as payment for tuition to their schools, or handed over their human property as payment for debts, records show. Some nuns expressed distaste for slavery, while others described their reluctance to sell the people they owned, and records document some efforts to keep families together. Sisters from both Georgetown Visitation and Sacred Heart united families in which the husband was owned by the nuns and the wife was owned by someone else. In each case, the sisters purchased the wives to bring the families together. The Carmelites of Baltimore cared for some elderly slaves when they grew infirm. The Sisters of Charity of Nazareth in Kentucky remained so connected to their former slaves that scores returned with children and grandchildren to celebrate the convent's centennial in 1912. But Dr. Mannard, a historian at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and other researchers have found that the nuns' financial needs and the appeal of unpaid labor often trumped any reluctance to traffic in humans. In spite of my repugnance for having Negro slaves, we may be obliged to purchase some, Rose Philippine Duchesne, who established the Society of the Sacred Heart in the United States, wrote in 1822. A year later, the Sacred Heart Sisters in Grand Coteau purchased their first person, an enslaved man named Frank Hawkins, for $550. In 1830, the Carmelite sisters cited concerns about having to undertake the disposal of our poor servants to help explain their reluctance to move to Baltimore from their plantation in rural Maryland. But they dropped those objections after learning that the sale would help pay off their debts and allow them to keep their rural estate. They sold at least 30 people, Dr. Mannard said. Nearly a decade later, the Sisters of Charity of St. Joseph's in Emmitsburg, Maryland, founded by Elizabeth Ann Seton, the first native-born American to be canonized as a saint, agreed to follow the counsel of their religious superior, who told them they could sell their yellow boys at 10 to 12% profit without doing an injustice to anyone. As for the Georgetown Visitation nuns, the profits from slave sales would become a vital lifeline during a period of expansion. In the 1820s, the sisters embarked on a building campaign which left them saddled with debt. To ease the financial strain, they sold at least 21 people between 1819 and 1822, the records show. When some buyers dawdled in making payments, the sisters took them to court, Dr. Nalazzitti found. The Sisters of Charity of Nazareth in Kentucky, who owned 30 people at Emancipation, were among the first sisters to seek to make amends. They joined with two other orders, the Dominicans of St. Catherine and the Sisters of Loretto, to host a prayer service in 2000 where they formally apologized for their slaveholding. In 2012, the Sisters of Charity of Nazareth erected a monument at a cemetery where many of the enslaved people were buried. So far, they have identified three descendants of the people they once owned. Older people still remember the days of segregated pews and segregated churches, said Father Gregory C. Chisholm, a black priest who heads the St. Charles Borromeo Resurrection and All Saints Parish in Harlem. Others have encountered racism within their own parishes and within their own religious orders, even as they cherish the blessings that Catholicism brings to their lives. This whole thing reveals the ways in which the religion has failed us in some way, said Father Chisholm, who says he is encouraged by the church's recent efforts to acknowledge its past. It's hard. It's difficult, but it's good. It's a way for our church to be renewed, and that's what it has to be. It has to be renewed. In November, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops addressed slavery in a pastoral letter that discussed racism within the church and asked for forgiveness. In 2017, Father Timothy P. Kosicki, president of the Jesuit College of Canada in the United States, the Jesuit Conference of Canada in the United States, apologized for the 1838 sale of enslaved people that helped keep Georgetown University afloat. The sisters say they still have work to do. At Georgetown Visitation, a committee is focusing on embedding the history more deeply into the school curriculum. The Sisters of Charity of Nazareth are creating a permanent exhibit on their campus that will highlight the contributions of African Americans to their congregation. The Religious of the Sacred Heart are weighing additional steps to promote inclusion and diversity and to eradicate racism within their order and in the schools they sponsor. Sister Dillard and other members of her committee have already visited some of the schools founded by their order, sharing the history that their sisters have unearthed and urging young people to commit themselves to combating systemic racism. She wants to make sure that students no longer grow up, as I did, without learning about the enslaved people who helped to build the church. She wants to make sure that we all know their names. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. If you have any comments or questions, or you see an article that you'd like to see featured on Religion in the News, please call us at 919-832-5138. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.